Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. Last week was episode one of my interview with Brendan Campisi, formerly of the Alberta Advantage podcast, about the history of the working class in Palestine. And last week we talked about that history under the Ottoman Empire, under British colonialism, going up to the Arab Revolt, and the beginnings of the Second World War in 1939. This week... This episode, we're going to have the second part of that interview, and we're going to talk about the Nakba itself, the experience of the Palestinian working class dealing with displacement, and the refugee situation, and the situation of Palestinian workers in Israel, under Israeli apartheid and occupation, going up to the First Intifada in 1987. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Like I said, we're going to continue this going forward. The third installment is going to be next week. Please stay tuned.
Yeah, because this is now we're talking like 1939, right? And now we're really getting into the last decade before the Nakba itself. So I'm assuming, like, yeah, so what does the trade union movement in Palestine look like after the revolt? And yeah, I mean, basically just take us right up to the Nakba now.
Sure. So basically, as I said, sort of ordinary trade union activity in Palestine had ceased during the war, and of course, economic life in general was, was very, very disrupted. But then once, once the revolt had been crushed, it would take years for nationalist activity to sort of recover in the same way. But then also, during the war, there is another one of these huge accelerated phases of capitalist development in Palestine, because during the Second World War, as we know, there's a North African theater of the war. There's fighting going on in the French colonies because you have, over whether those French colonies are going to be controlled by Vichy France or Free France. You have the revolt against the British in Iraq. You have the British and the Soviets sort of jointly invading Iran, in order to sort of ensure that they could do what they want geostrategically with it. So you have a huge amount of activity, in the Middle East during the Second World War. And Palestine, which is one of the places the British had an unbroken control of through the entire war, they build a huge network of bases. There's an enormous British military presence, and actually an American military presence as well, and things like the Polish army in exile. Anyway, there's an enormous Allied military presence in Palestine during the Second World War. They build a huge network of bases. And when I say they build a huge network of bases, what I mean is, of course, they have to hire workers in Palestine to build a huge network of bases and subsequently service them. Labor is already pretty tight in the Jewish economy. There are, Jews in Palestine who go to work in the sort of the war economy, the British infrastructure that's being built up. But mainly, this is a spur to a huge, huge growth of the Palestinian Arab working class. Tens of thousands of Palestinian Arabs enter into wage labor for the first time, because it's a huge opportunity to make more money than they would as peasants, right? Building this network of British military bases, and subsequently, servicing them. And so this actually leads to a huge revival of the labor movement. Because, again, it's a huge growth of the working class, and it's also the conditions of a wartime economy are pretty much the same everywhere, right? They're extremely inflationary. The labor market gets very, very tight. And so even if there are political restrictions on, labor action and strikes and so on, workers have a huge amount of leverage by default in a wartime economy. And they very much wanted to exercise that. And so you have sort of the renewal on a higher scale of the sort of really, really complex dynamic of the Palestinian, labor movement, where the Zionist sort of controlled Palestine Labor League is trying to organize this new workforce. You have the communists, and I'll get into detail what they're up to in a moment, trying to organize this new workforce. And you also have the Palestine Arab Workers Society, which is starting to change as well. To concretize that a little bit, I mentioned that there were these tensions that developed between Palestinian Arab and Jewish communists during the revolt. The Second World War is also a complicated time for the communist movement in the Middle East, because the initial line of the Comintern on the war is that it's an inter-imperialist war in which no sides are to be taken, and then subsequently from 1941, it is treated as an anti-fascist war. And this is highly complex in Palestine, because on the one side, it's deeply unpopular in the Jewish population of Palestine to say that the war between Britain and Nazi Germany doesn't really matter, in 1939. And then it's not especially popular in 1941 to say to the Palestinian Arab population or the Syrian and Lebanese population that they should support their colonial power, be that France or Britain, because that colonial power is allied with the Soviet Union and fighting fascism, right? From the northern or western perspective, from which these strategic lines were developed, you can make the case for them. I think obviously the Nazi-Soviet pact line was counterproductive in a bunch of different ways, but from the perspective of workers in the global north, radical workers in the global north, these things all have a logic to them in their own way. But for people in the colonial world, it's often quite different. Basically, the Palestinian Communist Party cannot navigate these things as a united effort. There's nothing, the general sort of problem that they faced was that there was nothing they could do that would be both, that would be legitimate in both communities, right? And so they broke apart. In 1942, the Palestinian Communist Party actually splits on national lines. And you have the Jewish organization continues to call itself the Palestine Communist Party. And then you have the Arab communists to establish an entirely new organization that does not take the form of a communist party, but takes the form of basically a radical nationalist sort of popular front group called the National Liberation League. And the National Liberation League is led by a cohort of young Palestinian Arab intellectuals who'd become communists in the 1930s, as well as some labor organizers. They are on the side of the national movement, of the nationalist movement, but they underemphasize the demand for independence while the war is going on, again, because they accept that Britain and the Soviet Union are allies and that it's necessary to save the Soviet Union from Nazism. But they really dive into the labor movement. They also do educational work. You know, they're very active in the intelligentsia from which most of them had come. They do political education. They publish a newspaper. All the sort of standard, Communist Party things. And they also start carrying out a great deal of activity in the branches of the Palestine Arab Workers Society, and especially in the largest branches of the Palestine Arab Workers Society in places like Haifa, Jaffa, Jerusalem. The members of the National Liberation League basically become the leading spirits of that. So you have a left wing that develops within this this labor organization that up to this point has been partly a creature of the conservative Palestinian elite, which is nationalist, of course. They want independence from the British. They want to stop the Zionists from taking over their country. But the elite nationalists obviously are not going to be the ones pushing working class demands in a very strong way. So the communists are trying to, they're trying to navigate the class struggle within Palestinian society. They're advocating for unity between the two nations. You know, they're trying to navigate this complex international situation. It's remarkable, the complexity of the situation they're able to, that they're actually able to navigate it. So you do have, during this period, you have the remarkable growth of the Palestinian Arab working class, the growth of organized labor, right? Union membership grows hugely. And you have a very strong left tendency, not necessarily a mass one, but in terms of who are the active, leaders, in trade union activity in Palestinian society at this time, the communists are playing a very decisive role. And this in turn has an effect on the Palestine Arab Workers Society. At first, the leaders of the Palestine Arab Workers Society try to stop this. And they pull some bureaucratic stuff where basically they try to argue that every branch in the union should have equal representation, even if the branches that happened to be where the communists were quite strong had far more members. There's the kind of bureaucratic struggle that goes on within, union structures all the time, and especially, at this time in history between communists and their opponents. But eventually what that leads to is a split in the Palestine Arab Workers Society, and the left-wing tendency in the Palestine Arab Workers Society breaks off, and they form a new left-wing trade union federation called the Arab Workers Congress. So now you have three organized trade union groups in Palestine, you have three organized trade union groups trying to organize Palestinian Arab workers. Again, the Palestine Labor League by the Zionists, the Palestine Arab Workers Society, and the Arab Workers Congress. And the interesting thing that happens with the remaining sections of the Palestine Arab Workers Society is that under pressure from the communists, they start to move to the left. And by the end of the Second World War, the leader of that organization, who's a man named Sami Taha, is starting to sound like a social democrat. He's influenced by the Labour Party. He has some contacts with the Labour Party in Britain. And he starts basically talking about trying to establish a Palestinian, social democratic party of some kind. I think the details like that, I think, are really important because it allows you to see that this was an entire, society that had its own political structure, it had its own social structure, it had all the same sort of problems and challenges as other, you know, societies facing colonialism, facing economic dependency in the same, you know, in the same time. And it's important in light of what would happen immediately after this, where the society is just sort of shattered completely. You know, you have a high period of labor activity. And again, in common with other situations, the more active workers are, the more different groups in the labor movement face pressure to actually work together, right? Workers who are on the offensive are not very patient about divisions between different groups of, you know, trade unionists. And so you do have some cooperation that goes on between these different union centers. And you also have, on the largest scale during this whole period, in the late 1940s, before, you know, basically from the late period of the war up to the UN partition decision in 1947, you have the largest scale cooperation between Jewish and Arab workers in Palestine. You have, for example, a very successful strike in the postal system, I think in 1946, that is, you know, international or binational. You have strikes of, you know, in the transport sector, truck drivers and taxi drivers, I think. You also have workers from both nationalities working together quite closely because they had a common set of economic demands. You know, they had the same things they wanted from their employers or they wanted from the government. But again, only within certain limits. Again, the historian of all of this, Zachary Lockman, is very careful to point, you know, he's not saying that there was some lost path of pure proletarian cooperation in Palestine, right? The national question was always going to come back. Right. There was no way to avoid that. But again, on the trade union level, you do have this remarkable period of cooperation in certain sectors. Again, the railways in Haifa continue to be that way. And also the oil refinery, you know, by the end of the war, the oil refinery in Haifa is operative. Right. Oil is being extracted in northern Iraq. It's being shipped across Jordan all the way to Haifa. And the oil refinery, I think, at that time is the largest industrial place in this part of the world. There's tens of thousands of workers, many of whom are Jews, especially many of the skilled workers are Jews, but also many of whom are Arabs. And the communists are strong there. And the, again, this sort of unusual cohort of sincerely internationalist left Zionist activists are quite strong in the Haifa oil refinery. And so relations between the workers there are quite good. And then, of course, the transition into first what can be called a kind of civil war, and then, you know, the ethnic cleansing campaign destroys all of this. There's actually a really tragic and very emblematic incident that Lockman ends his book with that takes place at this oil refinery in Haifa. So like many, you know, industrial workplaces in poor countries, every morning, a huge crowd of people lined up outside of this refinery, hoping for a day of work, right? And most of them, of course, are Palestinian Arab workers. And one day in 1947, after the partition resolution had been passed by the United Nations and the country is starting to descend into civil war, a group of revisionist Zionist terrorists threw a bomb into this crowd of Arabs, you know, waiting for a day of work, killed a few people. So the crowd then storms into the refinery and they start killing Jewish workers. And again, this is a place where the Jewish and Arab workers who were actually in this refinery together actually have very good relationships. And so you have many cases of Arab workers in the refinery trying to save their Jewish co-workers from, you know, this crowd. But I think you have something like 90 Jewish workers are killed. The Haganah, the mainstream Zionist armed group, outwardly they denounce the terrorist provocation, you know, by their right-wing Zionist rivals that started all of this. But then they organize a retaliation and they send a paramilitary force, into the village of Bawad el-Sheikh, which is sort of just outside of Haifa and where many people, you know, came to work in Haifa from. And they kill dozens of people, I think, a few days later. And so, you know, again, even in this longstanding center of, you know, a certain degree of cooperation between Jewish and Arab workers, you know, you have this descent into ethnic conflict. And then, of course, the you know, the whole society is just overturned. And, you know, Haifa and Jaffa, the centers of Palestinian Arab, you know, working class life that is, as they developed over the past, you know, several decades, are almost entirely, you know, ethnically cleansed of their populations. Basically, you know, all of Palestinian society, virtually all Palestinian society is physically, you know, is physically uprooted. And, you know, in a certain sense, it's actually really striking when you start reading, you know, work that was done on this in the 1970s and around then, because, of course, you know, we mainly think about, we don't think about the Nakba as sort of proletarianizing or primary accumulation. It seems sort of bloodless, right? It doesn't really seem to capture what's happening on a human level. But, you know, Marxist writers in the 1970s had no problem saying this. And of course, it's true, right? You know, I started talking about this by saying that most people in traditional Palestinian society had access to the land and ergo were not proletarians, strictly speaking, right? And what does the Nakba do? It deprives them of access to the land by the very crude fashion of forcing them out of their homes and out of their country at gunpoint. Of course, you know, primary accumulation in many parts of the world has involved forcing people out of their homes with physical violence. It's just that in Palestine, it's happened much more recently than in most of the world. So you have actually many people who had been peasants until 1948 who are deprived of the ability to continue to live in that way. And they become, you know, they become a big part of the labor force around the Arab world. You know, you have Palestinians serving as sort of the lowest, most super exploited section of the working class in Lebanon. You also have lots of people getting an education and becoming workers in the Gulf states, sort of white collar workers in the Gulf states. But the whole story of the Palestinian refugee diaspora and its economic role is too big. So I'm going to stay focused on what happens in historic Palestine instead of sort of trying to take up the entire the entire Palestinian experience around the world. That would be too difficult.
It's like that's true. I mean, that's absolutely massive story, because you'd have to start getting into like Latin America and like all these other places where the diaspora like outflows went to
Detroit, you know.
Yeah, like to this day, right? But you have this period, right? Like this initial period where, of course, like the refugee populations, you know, the West Bank is part of Jordan, you know, the Gaza Strip is part of Egypt in this this early part, like basically up until 1967, right? You have this this period where you have the refugee Palestinian population, but you kind of have a new chapter, you might say, of how they're of the situation where they're like, what would the is Palestinian, like, say, working class politics look like in this period?
So I guess I'll pick up the thread with the Palestinian communists and the national. Actually, first, I mentioned that in the late 1940s, the Palestine Arab Workers Society was starting to gain some independence. Right, it was starting to sort of slip the leash of the conservative, you know, Palestinian leadership. And there was some sense that it might become sort of the embryo of a Palestinian, you know, social democracy that would compete with the communists. Well, basically the old leadership does not like this. And Sami Taha, the leader of the Palestinian Arab Workers Society, is murdered in 1947, probably by sort of henchmen of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, who had been simultaneously the British appointed leader for Palestinian Muslims and the national leadership. He's a very complicated figure. Zionists love to talk about him because he cooperated with the Axis during the war. Actually, something I should mention also about the Palestine communists is that they were very important in opposing the pro-Axis trend in Palestinian opinion during World War II. A lot of people in the Middle East during World War II, and I should say, in a way that is entirely explicable for people living under the colonial rule of Britain and France, were, you know, kind of cheering for Germany and Italy, right? German and Italian agents were very active in the Middle East trying to stir this up, of course. And the Palestinian communists and the other Arab communists, whatever you can say about, you know, whatever errors they may have made, Palestinian nationalist forces in exile after the defeat of the revolt, who have certain dalliances with the Axis, which again, Zionists love to talk about it. In the big historical scheme of things, it's not especially, you know, it's neither especially surprising, you know, nor is it a hugely important thing that, you know, discredits Palestinian nationalism or whatever they want it to be. But the Mufti of Jerusalem, still a conservative, you know, leader from the old landowning class. He doesn't want an independent Palestinian working class party. And he probably has Sami Taha of the Palestine Arab Workers Society murdered in 1947. And that's actually a good foreshadowing of what happened to the rest of the workers' movement, which would face an extremely difficult time. The communists, of course, once the Soviet Union endorsed the partition of Palestine, the communists were forced to do it, right? That was the political culture of the international communist movement at that time. You could not defer a Soviet decision. You know, you could not make your reservations. You were simply not allowed to do this. If the Soviet Union had an attitude about a situation in the world, the Communist Party in that country, no matter the political problems it would create for them, they were, you know, they were bound to that decision, even though the Comintern as an institution no longer existed after 1943. So the Palestinian Arab communists defend partition. They defend partition in a way that is not incomprehensible, because basically they say, look, the partition plan says there should be a Jewish state and an Arab state. There's going to be a Jewish state. We can't stop that from happening. So we should make sure that we get this Arab state that we're supposed to get and not some other outcome like the one that eventually ensues where the Palestinian Arabs get nothing. But it's very difficult to do anything politically that's effectual towards this goal. Palestinian society is melting down. They put out a newspaper during the war, but I think as far as I know, that's the only activity they're really able to undertake. And then when the dust settles, you have, you know, the Palestinian population, as you mentioned, is split into these different zones. In the, you know, the 78% of Palestine that is now controlled by the new state of Israel, the former members of the National Liberation League, the Palestinian Arab Communists, reunite with the Jewish communists in the new Communist Party of Israel. And it's sort of a renewal of the binational communism that, you know, endures in that party, you know, to this day, although, of course, the Jewish component has shrunk significantly over time. And in Jordan, or in the West Bank, they end up, you know, under the control of Jordan. And basically, the Jordanian-controlled West Bank is the only place where some elements of the former Palestinian social structure are able to survive. Obviously, it's changed. You have the arrival of refugees, for example. But it's not like Gaza, right? Gaza becomes a completely new human environment because it is overwhelmed by the arrival of hundreds of thousands of refugees displaced from southern Palestine. Whereas in the West Bank, there are still many people in 1949 who are living in the same place that they've been living in 1947. And so there's a greater degree of continuity in political activity there and in labor activity there. Initially, the National Liberation League argues, basically, again, they have been in favor of the existence of the Arab state laid out in the partition plan. So they are opponents of the Jordanian annexation, right? As we now know, the Jordanian monarchy, the British-backed Jordanian monarchy and the Zionist state basically came to an accommodation, and they agreed that Jordan would take the West Bank and, you know, Israel would get the rest of Palestine. The Palestinian communists were opposed to the annexation of the West Bank initially. Eventually, they sort of had to accept it as a fait accompli. And so the group of Palestinian communists in the West Bank then become, in 1951, the Jordanian Communist Party. They are the, you know, the original sort of cell of the Jordanian Communist Party. And they actually become the crucial figures in the Jordanian labor movement over the next couple of decades. Again, I mentioned, you know, Jordan is under a reactionary Western-backed monarchy. And the political space available for oppositional politics, whether communist or nationalist, and for labor organizing in Jordan during this period down to 1967, expands and contracts quite frequently. There are brief periods where the communists are legal, and they're even able to win seats in the parliament, but those don't last very long. Most of the time, the party is underground. And there's also sort of periods that are more or less favorable for, you know, labor organizing. And at the worst periods of repression, you know, you have communists basically going to ground in the hills of the West Bank. you know, lots of communists, you know, cadre are imprisoned, the leadership are often operating in exile and so on. They endure, you know, a huge amount of repression. But they also are able to secure a real social base in certain places, in particular, in largely Christian towns and villages in the West Bank, in the area around Bethlehem, the area near Jerusalem, and so on. There's a number of villages and towns that become strongholds of the Jordanian Communist Party at that time, and that are actually still centers of strength for the left to this day. For various reasons, the Palestinian Christian community has sort of been more open to leftist appeals than the Muslim population. But in any case, you know, so you do have a certain centers of the Palestinian left, you know, that date to that time that still exist. In Gaza, there is no labor movement. And you know, the Palestinian Jordanian communists are able to build up unions in schools. They're organizing, I think, textile workers, miners. You know, they're able to, you know, build a fairly substantial trade union center over these decades. Although, again, it's sort of legal and political space is quite precarious. Gaza is very different, right? The Egyptians don't annex Gaza. And they're not hostile to Palestinian nationalism in the way that the Jordanians are. But on the other hand, they basically govern Gaza as a military zone where ordinary civil society doesn't exist. So coupled with the fact that there's very little industry to organize in Gaza, if I recall correctly, there were no unions in Egyptian-controlled Gaza. And the communists had to operate underground there. They actually did have a center, they had a certain base of strength in the early years, in the 1950s. And they were, you know, they were active in organizing resistance to the first Israeli occupation. Because, of course, Israel occupies Gaza for a period of months in the late 1956 and early 1957. And they carry out, you know, their first massacres there at that time. And the communists are active in organizing resistance to that, along with other nationalist groups, the Muslim Brotherhood and so on. But over time, they lose most of that popular support, and they become, you know, a fairly small group in Gaza, in particular, especially compared to the West Bank, where they do have a substantial, you know, social implantation.
Yeah, and of course, so this is kind of like you see new formations of, you know, proletarian expression, you might say, in Palestine. But again, you know, I believe we're noticing a pattern here. When you see the occupation of the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Sinai by the Israeli army in 1967, and annexation following that, you also see, you see another wave of dislocation.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, now we'll talk about the occupation. Really, really important source for understanding the economics and the class dynamics of the occupation is a book by an American scholar, Sarah Roy, who's basically the expert in the English language on Gaza. And she wrote a book all the way back in the 1990s called The Gaza Strip, The Political Economy of De-Development. And she makes this very particular argument about the economic policy of the occupation. And I think this is another example of what I said earlier about how the Zionist project, because it is not motivated by profitability, it is not motivated by sort of maximizing the exploitation of the native, the Zionist project does things that are different from other colonial projects. And so basically what Roy, you know, talks about in terms of de-development is this argument that Israeli economic policy, you know, in the occupied territories is not about creating a subordinate Palestinian economy that would meet Israeli needs. Like, for example, what the British did in India. It is about destroying a Palestinian economy. They don't want there to be a Palestinian economy, because the more of a Palestinian economy there is, then the more that a potential Palestinian state would have its necessary economic underpinning. So they make decisions to deliberately constrain Palestinian economic growth, Palestinian economic development, for a self-consciously political purpose of making sure that the conditions that would make a Palestinian state economically viable do not come into existence. There are exceptions to this, and we'll talk about between 1967 and the First Intifada is sort of the most conventional period of Israeli colonialism. I'll explain what I mean by that. But there is this overarching project that is not mainly about profit, right? It is about what the Israelis call security, which is a word that, you know, when they say it, what it means is basically the overwhelming predominance of the power of the Jewish state and the security of, you know, colonial settlement across all of historic Palestine, and, you know, in relation to the wider region, the ability to intimidate everyone around them. All these things are wrapped up in when Israelis talk about security. But the crucial point is that it is a political goal and not an economic one. You know, the economic element it's there, but it's sort of subordinate. And so there are these proletarianizing pressures that exist in sort of, we'll talk about the first period of the occupation as a distinct historical period. So from 1967 through the outbreak of the First Intifada at the end of 1987. And, you know, of course, as we know, this is the beginning of, you know, the building of the settlements in the West Bank. There's actually settlements in Gaza, of course, until 2005. They take up land, they take up water. You know, the Israeli state allocates every conceivable resource to them in a monstrously unequal fashion relative to, you know, the size of the Jewish settler population in the occupied territories compared to the size of the native Palestinian population who were there. And this makes it harder and harder for the Palestinian peasantry to make a living, right? So there is, through this period, a growing pressure to find other sources of income. I should also say, when I talk about de-development, I mean very concrete things in terms of Palestinian farmers have to ask Israeli permission to dig a well, and the Israelis never grant them this permission. All this exists to this day in the West Bank. You know, they have to ask permission to grant a well, to dig a well, and they're never granted that permission. It's extremely difficult for Palestinians to start businesses, right? So farmers, small property owners, small business owners, small manufacturers, you know, in the occupied territories face a huge, huge set of blockages, institutional blockages set up by the occupation, by the Israeli state, in order to prevent them from succeeding. They also face Israeli goods being dumped on their markets, right? Again, this is one of the more conventional features. You know, obviously, if you have a colony, you're going to use it to dump your product. You know, they're faced with competition from Israeli products. They're faced with sort of extra economic constraints by the Israeli state. And so it's very difficult for these classes to develop. It's very difficult for the, you know, any sort of capitalist, Palestinian capitalist class to develop on any scale under the occupation. And it's very difficult for the Palestinian peasantry even to sort of keep its head above water. So thanks to these pressures, you do have the continuing growth of working class. And the specific form that takes is that from 1968, you have huge numbers of Palestinian Arab workers getting up every day in the morning in their towns and villages and camps in the territories and going into Israel to work. And this has a political and an economic dimension from the Israeli perspective as well. The economic perspective is fairly obvious, but I'll go into some detail just to set the scene a little bit. So basically, Israel was rewarded for its victory in 1967 with a huge wave of investment, right? A huge wave of investment from the imperial core that takes a number of different forms. And so the Israeli economy in the decade or so after this is very, very buoyant. And they've sort of run out of new sources of labor within the Jewish society, right? Like, you know, in the 1950s, Israel takes in a huge wave of migrants, Jewish migrants from the Middle East, and they are the cheap labor of the Israeli economy in its early years. And then you have some incorporation of the Palestinian citizen population into the economy in the 1960s, especially. But they were running out of new sources of labor. And so it was obviously economically rational, right, for Israeli capital to start employing non-citizen Palestinians from the territories because they were an available source of labor. but also from the Israeli state perspective. It's important to remember, it can be very, very difficult to grasp this because of the situation today is so different. But even along with all of the incredibly repressive features that the occupation has always had, for the first two decades, the Israelis also have an idea that they are going to take a soft touch in the sense that if people are not actively involved in resistance, they wanted life to be tolerable enough for them that they wouldn't get involved in resistance, right? So, of course, for people who were fighting the occupation, it's always been, you know, the full, you know, panoply of administrative detention, torture, killing, you know, that we see, you know, under the occupation today. But as far as the, you know, the majority of the population of ordinary people in the West Bank and Gaza between 1967 and 1987, the Israelis wanted those people to be disincentivized from joining resistance, not just through terror, but also through allowing people to live materially, you know, decent, comfortable lives. And so there's also a political impetus, right? Between, you know, it takes a few months for them to decide that they're going to allow this labor migration to happen, although it's happening illegally before they do it. And the political motivation is, well, look, if people have jobs, they're making money, then they won't join, you know, the terrorists, obviously, from the Israeli perspective. And that, in some ways, proves to be a remarkably shrewd calculation. It runs out after 20 years. But at first, it has a certain degree of reality to it. Because this labor migration that starts, you know, in 1968, it really does change life, you know, for people in the West Bank and Gaza in a big way. First of all, of course, you know, talk about what is the work these people are doing. It is very much like other situations of sort of, you know, migrant labor between imperialist countries and underdeveloped countries, except that the underdeveloped country, so to speak, is right next door to the imperialist one. So these Palestinian, you know, workers, most of whom are men at first, eventually you have more women, you know, they're working on farms. They are working in sort of sweatshop industry. They're working in things like food processing, toys, you know, that sort of thing. They're working in hotels and bars and restaurants. And perhaps most importantly, they are working in construction. And that's, you know, sort of the niches that you would expect in this sort of situation. In southern Israel during this period, you would have men, you know, basically walking out of Gaza through the checkpoints. And the other thing I should say is that the key element of the soft touch approach of the first two decades is mobility, right? Today, we associate the colonial oppression of the Palestinian people with the constraint of mobility, right? The checkpoints, the siege on Gaza, the closures in the West Bank, right? All these things. But between 1967 and 1987, that was the last time that Arab people could freely travel through the whole of historic Palestine again, right? In fact, you know, you have people reconnecting with branches of their family who'd been, you know, behind the lines since 1948. You have people going into Israel to see their old homes. And the Israelis figure that that's the price, you know, is allowing people to move around, you know, freely. And one element of that migration, the most important element of that migration, is this labor migration. So during this period, you have every day men walking out of Gaza through the checkpoints onto the highways of southern Israel and standing around in what become known as the slave markets, waiting for somebody to hire them for a day of work. It's very, very similar to the southwestern United States, right? And the, you know, the Mexican and Central American, you know, men who stand around in Walmart parking lots in the morning, you know, in many American cities, actually not just that part of the country, but across the United States, waiting to be hired for a day of work. You actually sometimes see, and this is disgusting, but it's, you know, interesting from a sociological perspective. I've seen Israelis, you know, since October 7th saying, oh, you know, now these people want to kill us, but they used to tile our bathrooms, right? The implication is, oh, you know, these people could have been our happy little slaves. And we would have, you know, we would have thrown them a bone every so often, but they chose not to be. Again, obviously disgusting, but not really dissimilar in a lot of ways from, you know, Western society in general, right? This is the sort of the side of Israel that's kind of like a more violent, you know, California, rather than something that's super unique. Although, again, there are all these particularities we've been talking about. But this phase of this sort of large-scale exploitation of Palestinian labor is basically the one where Israel most starts to most closely resemble, you know, Texas or French Algeria or what have you. You also have some industrialization that goes on. You have some, you know, Palestinian industry, again, on a small scale. And then you also have a significant element of branch plant industry, right? Where, you know, an Israeli entrepreneur would set up, you know, some element of his supply chain, some element of his production process would be in the West Bank or Gaza. And he would have a sort of Arab, you know, front man, you know, who's supposedly owning this independent factory, but really it's, you know, working for Israel. And you have a lot more women working in those sectors. You know, of course, Palestinian families did not want their daughters going to work in Israel. You know, this is a conservative society. There's lots of restrictions on what women are allowed to do, which is, it's not really about religion, right? The Christian community does not really have a different set of ideas about gender than the Muslim population. But it's easier for Palestinian women to get jobs in the sort of sweatshops that are set up in this branch plant economy in the territories. Yeah, so that's the sort of pattern, and this becomes really integral to people's day-to-day lives for the next 20 years. And it, you know, people can make a lot more money than they did as peasants. This is the, again, it's like certain other situations, like, for example, southern Italy during the economic miracle, right? People have a lot more money coming in. The underlying structural weaknesses of the economy are still there, right? So it's sort of growth without development in a certain sense, right? People's paychecks are much larger. And you have, for example, you have a housing boom in the territories in the 1970s, where basically, you know, it's difficult to start a business, you know, it's difficult to get new farmland, it's difficult to become a successful farmer, all these things. So what the, you know, Palestinian householders who are getting this new source of income tend to invest in is building new houses and building additions on their houses. And that goes on a huge scale all over the territories in the 1970s. And you also have people buying appliances, they're buying TVs, all these things, right? They do get a little bit of the, you know, consumer modernity through this income, you know, that's coming in from even the lowest level of the Israeli economy, because of course Israel is an advanced capitalist, you know, society. Yeah, and so that's sort of the pattern that's established over that period of 20 years. And then I'll get into what organizing looks like in that context.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. place they arrest me. Materialist to test me. Pollution that chokes me. Movies that joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me. Hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.